And on the line now I have Gerry Lloyd, Assistant General Secretary of Mandate. Good afternoon to you, Gerry. How are you?
Good afternoon, Noel. I'm very well indeed. Thanks.
Okay. Now, before we talk about that, I just wanted to ask you a general question, because I'm talking to people over months, really, and I think it's in line with the conversation we're going to have as well. Most programmes you listen to on the telly and you hear the people talk, now we know the politicians live in a different world and that sort of thing, but in general when you hear people talking on the TV, there's always talk about 35, 40,000 as an average wage for workers in the country. Does that gall you when you hear that?
Yeah, and there's a huge assumption. First and foremost, Noel, can I just say thanks for inviting me on today. I think it's very important that on this day of all days, May the 1st, Workers' Day, that we wish all workers a very happy May Day. And I think it's very appropriate that we have discussions surrounding work and the future of work, indeed, on days like this. It gives it extra dimension and focus on it. But to come back to your point there, it absolutely does. I mean, there's a certain amount of presumptions written into those sort of declarations that average wage levels or whatever level they're at. The big misconception, and I think it's conveniently and very easily forgotten, is that not all workers, those figures are based largely on full-time work. And not all workers, and particularly within retail and the category and the sector that Mandate Trade Union deals with, the vast majority of workers, right across all of the major and small retailers, without exception, and we'd estimated somewhere to be in the region of about 80%, are not working full-time, but part-time workers. And most of them are involuntarily engaged in part-time work.
Okay, but would it be, the point is about full-time workers, would it be fair to say the majority of workers are on that type of wage? Because most of the people I talk to don't seem to think so, that people are on 600, 700, 800 quid a week.
Yeah, no, certainly not, depending again on the sector and how you allow certain sectors skew the analysis and who's doing the analysis. And again, we can talk with a fair degree of certainty and knowledge from the sector that we represent workers in. Our members and even those who are working full-time would be far below the figures that you've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as well, with conditions like everybody started working 24/7, overtime is nearly, well, gone out the window. You can correct me again if I'm wrong. People working Saturdays and Sundays, they work the same as if they were working midweek and that sort of thing. That's all changed now.
Yeah, there's been a huge concerted effort through the years to try and remove, and again, as a trade union, we've done our utmost to maintain certain premiums, whether it be on social hours premiums, whether it be public holiday working premiums, Sunday premiums. We've endeavoured to keep as many of them in play as we possibly can. But by and large, where there's no trade union involvement or presence, employers will just come in, and the general practice is you're offered the statutory minimum entitlements, whether that applies to your hourly rate of pay or right across a whole range of entitlements, including holidays and similar stuff like that.
Okay. So, negotiation, but a lot of people, I mean, you're calling on workers to organise themselves in the retail and bar for a specific sum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had a conference last week and there was a couple of main issues came out of the conference. One, we've set out, and we believe it's a very realistic expectation, that retail workers and bar workers, and we organise bar workers mandate as well, should have an absolute, as a minimum, an expectation to, overtime, albeit, but an expectation to earn, in the first instance, the living wage, which is somewhere in the region of 11.80 now, but rising to overtime up to 15 euros an hour, because we think it's crucially important, but anything less than that doesn't offer individuals and their dependents the opportunity to fully participate in within the society and indeed the economy in which they live. But crucially important, Noel, as well, I think there's a weighing scales effect here. On the one side, you have the hourly rate of pay, but we also have to ensure, and through the years and most in recent times, Mandate has been very successful in negotiating a range of what we call banded hours agreements, which on the other side of that scale ensures that people have a sufficient number of weekly hours to go along with the sufficient hourly rate of pay. Because after all, you could be earning 20, 25 euro an hour, but if you've only 5 to 10 hours a week made available to you, you can clearly see that it might look very attractive on paper to say. And some retailers say this. They come out and declare themselves as living wage employers. But they're solely focusing on the hourly rate of pay. it is crucially important that you get the balance right between the hourly rate and the number of weekly hours.
Is this to do, Gerry, with sort of zero-hour contracts that you're talking about? That it doesn't matter how much you're getting if you're not getting the hours to maintain a living standard?
Absolutely, and there's been far too much latitude afforded to employers in recent times. And indeed, when you see initiatives such as the statutory minimum wage and calls for the living wage, which is something different indeed to the statutory minimum wage, which after all is still only at $9.55 an hour, I mean, you've had far too much latitude afforded to employers who just crucially say, well, if I have to give a half-decent hourly, an increase to the hourly rate pay, I'll just cut somebody's hours next week. So you rob Peter to pay Paul, effectively. And that's why it's important, and mandate has been principally driving for the introduction of new legislation, and in particular our members in Dun Stores have fought for this for the last number of years, that at this moment in time we're in the final stages of new legislation being introduced, which will ensure, hopefully, sooner rather than later, and what we hear is it hopefully will be introduced in this session of the Dáil before the summer recess, that workers now will actually have a right to have their weekly hours determined on the actual number of hours that they've worked over an agreed average. So it's the hours that you've been actually working over a look-back period on an agreed average that will constitute your new minimum hours now in your contract. Therefore, taking away that absolute and total right and discretion that employers had to say to a worker, look, at if a contract there for 15 hours a week, you might in reality have been working 25, but at the stroke of a pen, and in particular if I have to give you an increase to your hourly rate of pay, I'm just going to reduce that next week by 5 hours. That's devastating for workers and their families. So on that basis, it's very welcome.
Okay, can I,
something we fought for, that the new legislation is on the way.
Okay, can I ask you, I mean, we're sort of inclined to copy things in Ireland, what's happening across Europe and the world. Is this a phenomenon that's in other parts of Europe, the 0 hours and the way things are worked here now and the living wage?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of all of those things, bits and pieces are taken from the experiences, not only across Europe, but also indeed across the world, you know. But I think there's a common trend here, Noel, is that if some employers, now I'm talking about here, not all, because we still have employers who want to do the right thing by their employees, but some employers, if they're given free range, they will just ratchet everything down, as I've said already, down to the basic minimum standards. And indeed, at a level lower than that, you have to keep an eye on other employers who will decide basically to try and break the law as well.
Okay,
and sort of ensure on a regular basis workers even don't get their statutory entitlement.
Okay, well, just talking about that, you talk about the big multinational companies and that who can possibly afford to pay all what you're asking for, but will that impinge on say, small businesses, for instance? How would you be with small businesses who maybe can't afford to pay this type of rate?
Absolutely, and of course, coupled to the call that we made at our conference last week, we clearly stated that any agreement such as an increase in the hourly rates of pay or indeed the weekly hours that we talk about should and can only be subject and evolve from negotiations with employers. Like in all collective bargaining that is conducted on that basis, regard has to have to be taken for the employers and the businesses' ability to be able to reach the demands that you're placing before them to meet. So of course, yes, you would do that. It doesn't necessarily mean that one size would fit all. It might be progressively over a period of time that some employers might be able to get to that rate of pay, and quite clearly it might be the case as well on the basis of evidence produced that some employers haven't got the capacity to do that. So you would be, but that's the complexity of industrial relations. That's the complexity of collective bargaining. And of course, you'll only ever get down to that level of detail if you're within the union, if you have somebody professionally out there representing your interests. But ultimately, you will have to meet what you find at the negotiating table and structure what evolves from those in negotiations accordingly.
Okay, can I ask you, I mean, a lot of cynics would say that this is like a recruitment drive for the unions. And to an extent, look, they haven't got the wally that they used to have many, many years ago, especially with some of the legislation that came in. So how do you fare with that?
Yeah, and sadly that's the case, and I wouldn't deny that. And I think there's a number of reasons, largely a lot of them are societal reasons. Obviously, we've come out of a very deep recession that hurt people very badly, I think the quality of work that's out there as well. People haven't got the luxury of being able to make the initial jump based on the disposable income of wanting to improve a lot, and by way of doing that, moving into a union. But clearly, and all the evidence sort of proves this, and I just go back to what I said a few moments ago, there was nobody, and particularly there was nobody from the employer side, and in fact it was quite the opposite, there was nobody sort of championing the whole sort of the need for banded hours legislation to ensure that workers benefit from the actual hours that they're working as opposed to, as I say, the minimum hours that's in their contract. And one thing I would say, Noel, and this is still one of the big benefits that a trade union, because I believe, and certainly I wouldn't do the job I do today, that trade unions probably are at their best when we're on the fringes of society. But a lot of the stuff we do, actually, we promote and have introduced, clearly understanding that it's not just going to only go to apply to our members. The legislation that I spoke about there, that's imminent, that will apply to all low-paid, precarious workers in this country. Mm-hmm. So that's the role of trade unions as well, to lobby and to progressively lobby and seek the introduction of measures that have the effect of looking after the most vulnerable workers in our society. Now, the next logical step we would like to see is for workers moving into a trade union and effectively organising themselves. And as I say, today of all days is probably very appropriate that you make that call, you continue to make that call, because without bringing that power of organised labour to the negotiating table, you'll be a long time waiting for employers, most employers, I would say. Again, I would state the proviso that some employers do the right thing by their workers, but most employers, we would find, you'd be a long time waiting for them to step up and do the right thing by workers.
And is there always resistance to the union in employment? Is it across the board always? Because, I mean, just thinking back to the 80s, that when you got a certain quota within a job, no matter how big or small it was, I remember talking to some people, I think there was only 8 people working on it, and the company said, yeah, that's fine, no problem at all if you want to bring in a union. Is there full resistance there all the time now?
Unfortunately, it's increasing. And we see evidence of that, not only in our attempts to try and recruit new workers and also try and organise new employment, but where we've seen some of the established employments as well, there's a tendency now to not behave in the manner in which the industrial relations has been conducted in recent times. And employers are showing a very distinct reluctance to come to a negotiating table and looking at ways and means possible as to how they will take away the collective power that I spoke about. See, employers get it now. Mm-hmm. They understand the power of the collective. They understand the powers of workers coming together, acting as one voice, negotiating as one voice. And so you shouldn't be in any way sort of surprised, but that's what employers, the reason why they're doing it. They get it. And I think it's our job, and it's constantly going to be the job of the trade union movement, to ensure at the very least that we challenge workers to understand the degree of power that they have, that when it's used wisely and not in a reckless fashion, the degree of parity of esteem and that balance between capital and labour that they can bring to the negotiating table and achieve the best possible results for themselves, their colleagues and their dependents. So if employers get it, you need to understand why that resistance now is there and why it's growing. Because they understand that if workers do effectively organise, well then certainly they will have a stronger and better voice within the employment that they work.
Okay, and when will all that start now to the extent of, you know, the campaign itself? Obviously it has started and you had your meeting last week. So in what form will it take over the next couple of weeks, for instance?
Well, I mean, the campaign is ongoing. I mean, that campaign is addressed on a constant basis when we serve claims on various employers. I would say, you know, and I think it's important to say this and for the listeners to understand, in a fairly significant amount of organised employment, based on the progress that a worker can make through an incremental pay scale based on their service, a lot of them can get up already to €15 an hour. And that's as a result, and you would say, well, I'd expect you to say that anyway, Jerry, but the evidence will show this.
Okay.
That's as a result of workers being, our unions being in the workplace and progressively agitating and negotiating on behalf of those workers. So that's ongoing. But I think the bigger question that we have to address as a society, and I think you raise a very important issue there, if we continue to see the growing reluctance from employers, see, in this country now you have a constitutional right as a worker to be a member of a trade union. But it means damn all if when you seek to assert that right, the first thing your employer turns around and says to you, I recognise you have the right, but I'm not going to recognise the union.
That's right.
So it has little value. So what we need to now start addressing, and I think the other issue we dealt with at our conference next week is, if employers continue to push into that space, well then I think there's another campaign which we launched last week that we are going to aggressively pursue now up to the next general election, and that's the right for statutory collective bargaining rights for workers. Because employers can't have it both ways. They can't simply ignore and tear up and diminish the value of your constitutional right as a worker to be a member of a trade union by simply asserting, say, well, you can be a member of the club. It's like sort of saying you can be a member of a football club, but I'm not going to let you play football.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have your right. We'll all recognise that you have a constitutional right. So if employers continue to do that and representative employer bodies continue to promote that type of approach, well, I think then they're fueling the evidence and the campaign that we certainly are now going to start pushing fairly aggressively for, which is the right to statutorily collectively bargain within your workplace.
Okay. So just to talk about, I mean, going back, I mean, a lot of workers, it wasn't sort of fear, it was sort of understanding of what happened 10 years ago. And a lot of people sort of held back in a way and said, well, okay, we let the country get on its feet and then we'll start to look. And then there's always excuses after. So you're facing an uphill battle here, Gerry, if you don't mind me saying so. Because people should be getting retrospective pay anyway.
Yeah, no, I think it's an astute assessment. I think workers have always faced an uphill battle. Through through time, workers and trade unions have always done that. And I think the point you make as well, and the way I interpret that point is, in good or bad times, there are certain employers who never want to pass on the benefits to workers. So there's always an excuse. And even after the years of recession, some employers have been very slow to come back to the negotiating table. And in fact, I thought it was interesting last week that you see the Minister of Finance himself urging employers now to start sharing some of the benefits to workers. But certain employers are very reluctant to do that, in good and bad times. It's always been a struggle. I think workers will always struggle. I think the power of capital, and increasingly so, I think workers sort of will be engaged in a constant struggle. But I tell you, one place not to be in the attempt to deal with that struggle is by your own or in some kind of disjointed or unorganised group within the workplace, because that will only lead to more control being ceded to certain employers. This is the time, more than ever now, because of the reasons that you've outlined, that workers should get organised and bring that collective power to the negotiating table.
Well, apart from what you're looking for per hour and a sort of a more consistent amount of hours worked, which should be fully up to, say, 35 to 40, will there be any sort of going back to people being compensated for very unsociable hours for working on weekends? Is that in the pipeline at all?
I think you want to be very realistic, and I think it would be wrong to give the impression that you could apply some kind of retrospective approach to premiums that weren't given or awarded to people in the past. But again, within the trade union organised sector, those premiums are still alive and well and being implemented onto a fairly wide sway of workers that we represent. But I tell you, Mitzi, there's two ways of looking at this. One is the past and what's foregone. But then you need to look at the future and you need to say to yourself, well, if other workers in similar circumstances are achieving these type of benefits, how are they achieving that? And what do we need to do now to move into that space? And I think largely you will find that the workers that don't have any of those benefits applied to them are not in the union, are unorganised in respect of being able to bring that collective power to the negotiating table with the employer. So it's looking forward, I would urge workers to do. Understand why you don't have it and start to understand and do something about it, how you might get it.
Do you think that, I mean, they keep talking now about full employment out there, and do you think the figures may be jiggled to the extent that we have all these zero-hour contracts and we have people being underpaid for the work they're doing, actually? Do you think that there's a false sort of economy out there as far as the full-time employment is concerned?
Well, two things I would say on that, Noel. They're talking about full employment at the moment, but still recognise there's somewhere just above 5% of people who are unemployed. And there will always be that group of people who are more difficult. They tend to be long-term unemployed. They tend to be institutional unemployment in that group. But partly as a society, we shouldn't give up on them. We should continue to sort of work with them to ensure that they have every possible opportunity to re-enter the workplace. But not only to re-enter the workplace. See, we have a slogan in here, Mandate, and we firmly believe that work should pay. So to entice anybody to come from the unemployment ranks, there should be seen to be progressive. So a lot of the problems that has been encountered, particularly by unemployed people, is when you look at some of the quality of the jobs that are out there, the hourly rate, the hours of work being offered every week, it's clearly not a case that it's progressive for them, their families, and it's not a case that work should pay. Mm-hmm. I think the second point that I want to make is the point you've just raised there. Yeah, I think we can get a little bit carried away. It's not about the number of jobs being created in any given period. We should also be talking about the quality and interrogating the type of jobs that we're talking about here as well.
Yeah, because
so it can't be all just about quantity. It has to be about quality. And you will find that a lot of the jobs leave a lot to be desired. Hence, up to very recently, you know, there was a bit of an amazement over in the Collector General's office and in the Revenue Commissioners, because the growth in revenue receipts from PAYE and direct work taxes wasn't rising in accordance with the same growth that was in the employment stats. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is a lot of the jobs that the people are moving into, they don't earn enough to pay PAYE and CRFR.
Apart from that, Gerry, you just thought of a new phenomenon that someone was telling me about recently, where people have been up for jobs, all right, but they're asking within the whatever firm they may be working, is that they work for themselves.
Yeah,
they pay their own taxes, they pay their own PRSI and that sort of thing. This is a new phenomenon. Will you be doing anything about that, for instance?
That's commonly referred to known as bogus self-employment. Mm-hmm. We've seen it creep into the construction industry many years ago. And to a large degree, it's decimated the whole sort of, you know, the structure of the construction industry. Now it's a bit of a bounce back there at this moment in time because of the change in our economic circumstances. But clearly, again, there are laws already in place that determine what constitutes a worker and what constitutes a contractor. But they are being stretched to the most credible degree, by some employers who are effectively taking some of the most mundane jobs and declaring that the people are contractors, they're self-employed. Of course, they've no responsibilities. And this is the depth. I spoke about it earlier, Noel.
Mm-hmm.
This is the depth. Unchallenged, the extent of the depth that certain employers will go to. Not only are they happy and are they not happy by giving people the minimum wage and sort of insecure weekly working hours, but they look at every other means way possible to ensure that they don't have to play their part of being a responsible employer. And that's yet again another example. And again, I would say it doesn't tend to happen within the organised sector. You will hear those horror stories, and we have to deal with some bad stories ourselves. But I always say, you can only imagine if we have to deal with some sort of dire circumstances and challenge employers in so much as to improve those circumstances for the workers involved. If that's happening in the unionised sector, mm-hmm. you can only imagine what's happened where it's not unionised.
Indeed. Okay, I'm afraid we're running out of time. I'm going to have to leave it there. But let's hope that things improve for everyone all around and your campaign is successful. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, Gerry. Thank you very much.
Very good, Noel. Thank you.
Stay there. Thank you. And that, of course, was Gerry Lloyd, Assistant General Secretary of the Mandate Trade Union.